This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm David Lazarus. In my day job at the Los Angeles Times, I'm the paper's consumer guy, the one you turn to when you've got some business headache to remedy, and I see my share of scams. So do you, it turns out. At least that's the impression we got when we sent our reporters onto the streets of New York and L.A. to chat with people who've gotten a bitter taste of scam soup.
Once there were just people sell on the street, you know how they try to sell you like these packages to hair salons or something? They're usually by colleges and by schools. They try to get a lot of students to buy them. So I think I ended up buying a package for like $60 and called the place and it didn't exist.
It was a dermatologist, yes, at the doctor's. I went for a prescription and I was charged $500 for a doctor visit where nothing was done. So I was conned.
I think I was at the tennis center in the Queens, and the guy was selling tickets. And so he sold us a ticket. I think we paid like $70 or $80 for it. And then when we tried to go through, these tickets were user ready. But I think we spent $140, $150 for tickets. And my husband went to look for the guy. And of course he was gone. He wasn't there. He ran away as soon as he sold us the tickets. So we were like fools to fall in for that.
But wait, there's more. A few weeks ago, we asked you to write in and tell us stories about scams you've encountered, and you flooded our inbox with some pretty horrific experiences. John Gentile of Miami emailed us with a particularly striking story. He lost $150,000 to a Ponzi scheme run by a lifelong friend, thanks, dude, and got several members of his family caught up in the racket as well. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So how are things in Miami?
Well, it's a beautiful day here. It's about 80 degrees, very nice, sunny.
Good day for scams?
Yeah, it's always a good day for scams down here.
Well, tell me your story.
I guess about 15 years ago, I began to invest with a good friend of mine, someone I knew for 38 years, and he approached me about doing first mortgages on properties. And I asked him to explain it. He said to me, well, these are people that they don't have enough credit to go to the bank, but their property is secured by the mortgage that we're going to get is going to be a first mortgage secured by the value of the property. And I said, yeah, sounds good. So I gave him some money and did well. And a few years later, I gave him some more money. And then my family asked me about it, and I explained it to them. And I said, it's been good to me. And a lot of us gave him money. My family did, to the tune of about $1.8 million.
A lot of money.
A lot of money over the span of probably from 99 to, I would say, 2009, probably about 10 years.
And what kind of return did you get on an annual basis?
We received interest payments every month of between 10 to 12%.
So that's a great return. You can't argue with that.
No. I thought it was a fine return. Again, he was somebody I felt he could have been part of my family. That's how much I trusted him.
And then?
Well, the check started to bounce. And then more checks started to bounce until finally it became obvious that there was a problem. So I met with him and I said, look, Warren, you got to do something. Cut the interest rate. Do something. Yeah, I'm going to fix it up. I'm going to cut the interest rate. My sister, who had a lot of money invested along with me and my mother, my mother-in-law, my sister-in-law, we went to an attorney. They said, we don't handle this, but we got to tell you, this looks like a Ponzi scheme. A what? A Ponzi scheme from my good friend of 30 years? Can't be. No way. We called him in, and I'll never forget, he sat in my office with myself, my brother-in-law, and another investor, and he said, things were done wrong, and I know I could go to jail, and I'm prepared to do so if I have to. So we knew we were in deep trouble. We contacted an attorney. We instituted a civil suit, which didn't amount to much. We then went to the FBI, and they arrested him for mail fraud and a Ponzi scheme. He was tried, convicted, and in July of 2011, he was sentenced to 17 and a half years in federal prison.
And for anyone who doesn't quite know, a Ponzi scheme is a racket whereby you're constantly bringing in new victims to bring in more money, and the money gradually makes its way to others. And those who get in early tend to get some money. Those who get in late tend to not get so much money. This is how Bernie Madoff got into so much trouble. Do you have any idea, John, how many people were victimized here?
You know, somewhere in the realm of around 45 to 50 people there. Again, my family was maybe six or seven, but there are other people in other groups that were involved.
Were there actually properties out there that were being invested in?
Well, that's what he says. The problem was, and this is certainly a mistake I made, and when I'm asked about it, you know, we never received anything. We never received any mortgage documents. Of course, you could say to me, John, how stupid you were. And I would say, David, you're right. I mean, I realize that now, as it's easy to look back on someone that you'd known for many years. But there were properties that he was investing in. They were homes. They were apartment buildings. Again, they were first mortgages, but we never received anything. Towards the end, when things got bad, he gave us a promissory note, but that was not worth much more than the paper it was written on because there wasn't anything at that point. He lost everything. Apparently, everything went into foreclosure. He lost his own personal property, his other properties, businesses that he had. By the time he went away, there wasn't really much, according to the FBI, of value at all.
How much did you and your family lose?
Almost $1.8 million.
So the whole thing?
Yes.
And there were no properties to fall back on, to foreclose upon, to,
no.
to walk away with?
There was nothing. The FBI went after that. There were businesses. And they say this is typical. They say that by the time the scheme unravels, there's not a lot there.
When he actually had his come-to-Jesus moment in your office and admitted something was amiss, did you see remorse in his eyes? Was he contrite?
Did I see remorse? He never said he was sorry. Someone asked me that the other day. He never said, I'm very sorry. He said, things were done wrong. People let me down. I know I can go to jail. He never said, I have to tell you, John, I'm so sorry for you and your family. No. You know, he's a sociopath. And sociopaths, I read about this a lot. They don't think they did anything wrong. They're liars. They really think that they helped you and you didn't get it. The only time he ever apologized was a generic apology in court in front of the judge. That's not worth the hill of beans to me. I'm sure his attorney said, you better apologize, you know? That's it.
So, John, if I told you that I've got a great scheme for making some money for you and your family, what would you tell me?
Boy, I would go so far the other way, you couldn't even find me, okay?
John, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Scams and ripoffs come in all shapes and sizes. There are the big rackets, like the Ponzi scheme we just heard about. There's the nickel and diming you get at the hands of banks, right? And then there's everything in between. Hillary and Jim Callahan live in Birmingham, Michigan. They were scammed out of cash by an automated ordering scheme through their L.L. Bean credit card. They wrote to us about it at marketplacemoney.org. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right. So tell us what happened with the tale of two watches.
Well, it's more than two, but I'll let Jim.
I had ordered something from L.L. Bean, and in the process, I used my L.L. Bean credit card. And then I was asked, as a pop-up, would I be willing to evaluate my transaction with L.L. Bean? And I said yes. And then I was asked a series of questions. And at the end, it basically said, because of your willing to do this, we will send you a watch for as long as you pay the shipping charges, which I believe were $599. So I said, okay, fine. Anyhow, so the watch came, and it was no big deal. It's just an ordinary watch. And then another watch showed up, and I said to Hillary, there must be a mistake that they've made here. Because, you know, we didn't order any watch, and the second one
is
here.
And there was no label on the outside.
Yes, and we were trying to find out, you know, who had sent it and how to send it back. But
we still thought we were dealing with L.L. Bean.
Yeah. So then I got another watch shortly thereafter. And
this is number three now.
This is number three. That's when I became very suspicious about what was going on. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, since I only used my L.L. Bean credit card to order things from L.L. Bean, I wasn't even bothering to look. Unbeknownst to me, however, they were being charged, or we were being charged, roughly $50 each for these unsolicited watches. And I was perturbed. So I finally called L.L. Bean, and they referred me to the credit card, which was Citibank, who was controlling that issue. And when I called Citibank, and they said, well, we can get you a name for you to call or a number. So I got the number. A young lady answered the phone. I explained the situation. I said, I never ordered these watches. I never authorized these watches to be sent. And she said, well, I'll get you a return. You can't send the watches back to us without a code number or a return number. And I said, I would like to have that. And she said, I will get that to you shortly. About a week went by. I heard nothing. Now take a look at my L.L. Bean credit card. And there is now late charges attached. So I kind of blew up at that particular point. And I called and I said, look, this is ridiculous. You must have given these people my credit card number. I don't know how else they would have gotten it. And they said, "No, we didn't do that. But we will, we'll get. I can get you some information as far as the name of the company and where it is." So then I began to have this email back and forth with the people at the MNC watches. And he said, "I didn't read the fine print because the fine print, when I spent the $5.95." It said that I would was authorizing them to send me something once a month.
You had to call them and tell them that you no longer wanted to be an auto dealer.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing like when a charge for a ringtone, for example, ends up on your cell phone bill. And you wonder, well, how did AT&T or Verizon allow that to happen?
Yeah.
Well, they've got a relationship with that other company.
Oh.
And that's probably what happened here. All right, so where are we at now? First of all, how deep in the hole are you? How much money has been involved here?
I think the credit card was hit for like $149 over the couple of months. And frankly, I've got two watches and boxes I can sell you if you're interested.
Nah, I think I'm good on the whole watch thing at this point. Here's the big takeaway here, and that is when you see online surveys, that's always a red flag.
I didn't know that, and we do now.
Yeah, we do now.
Now you do. I mean, be very careful. And when it comes to fine print, I don't know if they gave you the fine print or not. And sometimes some more scammy operations will claim they had fine print, and there was no disclosure whatsoever. So in this case, they had to get your credit card information from somewhere, and I'm guessing it was Citibank. But all financial institutions need to do a better job of housekeeping to make sure that parasites like this don't get anywhere close to their customers.
Amen.
And at this point, I'd say with those cheapo watches there, eBay is your friend.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. I appreciate it.
Jim, Hillary, thank you very much for joining us.
You betcha.
Thank you.
Craigslist can be a great place to find deals. It can also be a nest of vipers when it comes to con artists. Tony Tabora Roberts wrote to us on Facebook about a time she and her fiancé used Craigslist to hire movers and then got taken for a ride along with their furniture. Hiya, Tony.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So a few years back, you made a move from San Francisco, the Bay Area, to Davis, California. Did all go smoothly?
Not quite. We were moving, and my husband was starting to go to grad school, so we didn't have a lot of money at the time. So we tried to look for movers to help us make that move, and we found some movers on Craigslist, and we got scammed.
Did they seem to be a reputable company, or was it a couple of guys in a truck?
It was a couple of guys in a truck.
And when they pulled up in front of your home in the first place, and you saw that it was a couple of guys in a truck, did you have any misgivings?
We did. One of the guys looked like, you know, what you would expect for a mover, but one of the guys didn't look like he was in great shape to be a heavy lifting mover. So we definitely, our hackles were a little up at that point, but we felt like there was no turning back.
What did the other guy look like?
He was kind of this scrawny older man, maybe even in his 70s. And, you know, we were moving large boxes and furniture up and down stairs. So we were a little concerned about that.
I'm sorry. So Grandpa Walton shows up and these guys are going to move you and you guys are going, oh, okay.
Yeah, we're moving. You know, we didn't have, you know, just a little bit of stuff. We, you know, that's why we hired movers. We had quite a lot of stuff. So that was maybe one of the first signs.
And they gave you an estimate up front, I assume?
Oh, yeah. No, I think we had I remember that we worked it out ahead of time because, you know, we had to know if it was within our budget. And, you know, movers ask you those typical questions of how many rooms do you have and how many boxes, that sort of thing. And so we'd worked out the price in advance.
And what was the price?
I think it was about $250.
Cheap.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that was within our budget.
Okay. So even though you were going to put the older fellow in the hospital with this move, you know, great. You're getting off okay. So these guys pack up the truck, cart it all off to Davis, and what happens?
No. Actually, they moved all the stuff out of our house in San Francisco, and then as you know, they've got all the stuff in the truck outside of our house, and they say, "Well, you know what? That was a lot harder than we thought. So we need more money." After it's in the truck, and so you know, we were like, "Well, you know, we agreed to this price. you know, well, we can't pay you more money. So they said, well, if you don't pay us, we'll put all your stuff out here on the sidewalk.
How much more did they want?
We worked it out to be $150. And not only that, when once, you know, we had to follow them to, you know, in our car to Davis, California, which is, you know, an hour and a half away. And we kind of had to help them move the rest of the stuff on the other end.
You had to unpack the truck?
Yeah. So we had to help. You know, we were doing that anyways, but, you know, we just had to do a lot more than we expected.
Did you know that the moving industry is regulated?
No, I didn't.
Do you know which agency in California regulates the moving industry?
Department of Transportation?
No, maybe? It's the Public Utilities Commission, of all things.
Oh, that's weird.
Who knew, right?
I would have never guessed that.
Exactly. It's not well publicized, I think, and I believe moving operations in virtually every state is regulated as well. And everybody listening should be aware of this, that this is a relatively common racket. And if your stuff gets held hostage, and I've heard stories about the movers actually taking people's stuff to a storage facility and not even giving it back until they get the money they want, you want to go to the authorities. I mean, I understand completely, Tony, that you didn't want to mess with these guys. Who would, right?
Right. And I don't even know if we felt like we could track them down. You know, I don't know. They just seem pretty shifty.
Yeah. You still use Craigslist?
You know, I do. I still use Craigslist for personal, like one-to-one, you know, selling of items. But no, I never go to the services anymore. I don't trust that.
Tony, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Many scams occupy a legal or ethical gray area. So what might look like a ripoff to one person could represent a nifty business opportunity to another. Marie McDonald lives in Winthrop, Massachusetts. Several years ago, she purchased her first home in southern Maine, a fixer-upper in a nice neighborhood. Now she realizes the broker, the seller, the closing attorney, even the home inspector were in cahoots during her deal. Marie came to us via the Public Insight Network. Nice to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on here. I'm a big fan.
So you're in the Boston vicinity, is that right?
I am. I actually live in a little town called Winthrop, right outside Boston.
Did you know anyone who ran in the marathon?
You know, I did know a lot of people who, you know, were in the marathon or who worked at MIT or who were at the finish line.
Were any of your acquaintances injured?
No, thank goodness. Mercifully, yeah. But it touches everyone.
All right, Marie, let's shift gears here. We're talking scams, tragedy of a different nature.
Yes, much more minor nature.
Tell us your story.
Oh, okay. Well, my story started, it was quite some time ago. It was about a decade ago. I had been very, very, very eager to buy a home. And, you know, I didn't really have a lot of resources or a lot of help, but I had looked and looked and looked and looked, and I did what they tell you to do, which is I found the worst house in the best area.
And how do you define the worst house in that neighborhood?
Antique would be kind of a fancy word. Antique mobile home from probably the 50s on its own little piece of land in lovely, lovely southern Maine. So it's a beautiful area right outside Portsmouth, but the structure itself is a nightmare. Like you would see it on, you know, one of those reality shows where they're just going to tear it down like with their bare hands.
All right, so now you've got this haunted mobile home from a Stephen King story.
Yeah.
Southern Maine, but still, what happens?
I ended up trusting the realtor that I had found the home through when he said, hey, no problem. You know, the seller can finance it for you. I said, well, that's great. That's wonderful. Sign me up. Not really realizing that perhaps there were some ethics issues that might not be observed there in terms of disclosure. He basically asked me, you know, very leading questions about my finances and then promptly turned around and reported those answers to the seller.
So just to be clear, the realtor is representing both you and the seller.
Yeah, dual agency, I think, is what it's called.
So that's a very, very mixed interest here.
It is supposed to be acceptable, but there are supposed to be, you know, certain restrictions that are observed, and I don't see that they were. One question that was asked me was, what's the highest interest rate you might find if you're looking for a mortgage before I had agreed with seller financing? And I said, I don't know, and I just pulled a number out of the air. So I said, oh, you know, well, hopefully I can get something for less than 13%. So that's the rate that I got from
the seller.
That's
a funny coincidence, huh?
I know. And I had a, you know, an attorney for the closing who looked over all the documents and didn't really seem to do anything other than sort of sign off on everything. So I don't know, you know, what the convergence was that, you know, the various professionals that I had involved and that I had trusted didn't really come through. But
wait a minute, did you have an inspector come out and look at the place?
I did have an inspector come out, and it turned out my realtor said, "Hey, I know an inspector you can use." And I said, "Great, I'll call him tomorrow." So I had the inspector that the realtor recommended come out, and they were apparently good buddies. They were chatting. It's a small town. And he inspected the place and said, "Yeah, no problems. It's all fine." But in reality, it was really, really, really as far as you can get from fine. The piping for the kitchen sink for the drain wasn't there.
The inspector missed that part?
Yeah, he's just going to sign off on it anyway.
All right, there's some moving parts here, obviously. And the first thing which you have highlighted very clearly is don't let emotions get in the way of money.
Now, isn't a home purchase always, you know, your first home always going to be an emotional investment, though?
As is your first car. So, yes. And it's always good to have a friend or a family member or
inspector, maybe.
Yeah, or the guy who missed the kitchen sink to at least gut check you and be able to ask the right questions. Unfortunately, you didn't have that team on your side. And that's where the quote-unquote scam kind of got into place here, is because you're dealing with some guy and his cousin. And I think one takeaway from your experience is once you start seeing those red flags pile up, and I don't care how nice a piece of property it is, you walk away at that
point. Yeah, you don't keep walking through the blizzard.
Yeah, exactly. You don't figure that the weather's going to clear up.
Very true.
So you got to go in with your eyes open. Now, as for what you do here, this is obviously going to be your call. You might want to hold on to it as an investment asset, as long as it's not burning a hole in your pocket. And is it? Are you paying a lot in property taxes?
No, it's very reasonable. And I mean, it's been vacant for several years. So I've been paying mortgage and rent on the places that I'm actually living in because I don't live there anymore.
Marie, if it was me, I'd hang on to it because, hey, Southern Maine, you know, what's not to like?
This is true. I mean, it's a nice big piggy bank.
Marie, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much for your help. I appreciate it.
And that's all the time we have for scams on the show this week. But we're continuing the conversation online. Go to marketplacemoney.org for a list of 10 simple things you can do to make sure you don't get taken to the cleaners.